KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Julian Assange, Edward Snowden, these are just two of the famous whistleblowers who leaked documents pertaining to secret drone warfare and mass surveillance. They're also featured in Verax, a new graphic novel that digs into the history and ethics surrounding drones and surveillance. And joining us in studio are the two people who created the book. I want to welcome Khalil Bendib. He's an editorial cartoonist and graphic novelist whose other book is Zahara's Paradise. Welcome to the program. Welcome back, actually. We had you.
Thank you, Michael. Yes, it's
great Zahara's to be Paradise. Back. Good to have you. Also good to have Pratap Chatterjee here with us this morning. He's an investigative journalist and executive director of Corp Watch and the author of Iraq Incorporated and Halliburton's Army. The book they co-authored is called Verax Again, The True History of Whistleblowers, Drone Warfare, and Mass Surveillance. And welcome to both of you. Good to have you both here.
Thank you for having us, Michael.
Well, let's begin I should mention, full disclosure here, I interviewed Edward Snowden last night at a big event at the Curran Theater, and your title is actually a code name for Snowden.
That's right.
It is.
But the book goes well beyond Snowden. I mean, it begins with kind of a search for the links between big business and surveillance, and it moves us into all kinds of territory, Julian Assange, drones particularly, and so forth. Covers a lot of territory. It's a big canvas, and it's basically a graphic novel, but it's a kind of, I just want to get the subgenre here out, a hybrid of journalism and storytelling.
Exactly. So how do you reconcile those two concepts? Journalism, which is all about...
Bob Woodward, Carl Bernstein, they try to do it.
That's right. Journalism, which is all about accuracy and truth and precision, and comics, which is about entertainment and humor sometimes and entertainment.
Well, somehow it works. I mean, it works because there's a lot of stories to be told here that are sort of congealed together, and cartooning is very good and admirable, to put it mildly. But let's talk about what you were after in this book, maybe we can get you... on that, Pratap, because actually it begins with you trying to get funding to different places to do the investigative work you wanted to do. And I was saying to Dan Zell before we went on the air, it's almost a kind of picture of how difficult it can be for journalists now, not only to keep a wage-earning job, but also to get money to go to different places. From your editor's standpoint, you're going back with these software brochures. You know, this is not serious investigative journalism. But, of course, it was.
Indeed, the subtext to the story, Verax, which means truth-teller in Latin, not to give away the book. It's about whistleblowers, but the subtext is actually about journalism and how difficult it is today to be able to get that money to go out and do the kind of in-depth, long-term kind of work. And, you know, editors like dead bodies. They like smoking guns. They like...
tabloid, too.
Exactly. So they don't want a story about how things work. That's, you know, that's for science television or some such thing. And so to convince people that surveillance, back in that day, because this book begins in 2011, before Edward Snowden, was difficult. And drones were a little more sexy because drones kill people. And so I wanted to actually connect the dots between those two stories. And that's what we've tried to do with Verax. Indeed, we always say that Snowden only told half the story. Snowden did say when he came out and revealed what he knew and gave all these documents to the public that the reason he did it was because he saw what mass surveillance did and its connection to drone killing. But in fact, he doesn't talk about drone killing very much, and they are very intimately connected. And that's what we explore. So a lot of people in the United States are concerned about privacy. But this goes way beyond that. There is a reason they want our data. They want to find people, they want to put them in jail, and perhaps kill them.
And, in fact, there is a killing that takes place early. I don't want to give too much of the plot away, and thank you for correcting me. I was saying Verax in my head. It's Verax, right? Yeah.
But we're not sure.
And it's yeah, that's how we chose to pronounce it. We're used to
I will defer to you here. Henceforth say Verax, but... I mean, a young 16-year-old gets killed. It's a young 16-year-old named Tariq in Pakistan who you were talking to.
Indeed. So I traveled to Pakistan with a group that was doing a conference of drone victims. That is to say, families of people who were killed by drones. There are about 50 people there. Among them were two people who were actually injured in drone strikes. And so I filmed everybody that was there because I was working at the time for a group in Britain called the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. I took down stories, and I went back to Britain to write up my stories. And 3 days later, I got a call from a lawyer, the lawyer who put together the conference, who said, guess what? one of our one of the people who attended the conference was just killed in a drone strike. And here's the interesting and ironic thing about it. He asked me to send him the pictures of any teenagers that I met named Tariq. And so I sent him a picture of somebody called Tariq, not realizing, in fact, that there were two Tariqs. This actually is very important because it is very easy, even though I met these two Tariqs in person and had dinner with them, I forgot that there were two of them. And
it's also kind of a metaphor for how drones could hit the wrong targets.
Exactly.
They
exactly.
often do.
And they often did, unfortunately, sadly, and tragically. There's a real story to tell here, and let's talk about it a little bit with you, Khalil. I mean, about drone use and the destruction and not only wrong targeting and so forth, as I indicated, but a real story about PTSD and drones.
Exactly. So it's the story. Originally, my idea was to do something about whistleblowers. I was inspired by Bradley, now Chelsea Manning. Wanted to do something about him, now her. But in the meantime, this incredible explosion of revelations from Snowden happened, and I contacted Protap. I told him, let's do something. I knew it was his beat. He'd been covering this mass surveillance and drone warfare for years. And we decided, let's do this is nonfiction, even though we call it a graphic novel. It's not really a novel. It's a story.
I should tell you, there are a lot of graphic novels that are based on real stories.
Exactly,
now,
yeah. These days, yes. So we decided to do that thing together. And in the course of his investigation, Protap gets to meet these other whistleblowers who are not as famous as Snowden and Assange, who used to be in the military and who have PTSD and have been badly damaged by operating drones and helping kill people who they knew were innocent. So these people are completely destroyed by that knowledge and that experience.
That was very revealing, although there is a moment early on when you have one of the pilots who's conducting a drone strike act very cavalier about it and, you know, just kind of fly off into the horizon. And
that was from a real transcript, an actual none of the content of this book is fictional. It's all real words from real people.
So, yes, the American Civil Liberties Union filed a Freedom of Information Act request, which is a staple of investigative journalism, and found this transcript, 4 hours of voice chats between the pilots, the operators, and the imagery analysts, and the soldiers who were in helicopters. And here's the difference that I think most people don't realize. People just assume that a drone is operated by a pilot, and perhaps there's a gunner, and that's it. Actually, behind every Predator, there are 180 people. Behind every Global Hawk, there are 500 people. And it involves not just a pilot, but also, and commanders and things like that, but also imagery analysts, geolocation analysts. And so the imagery analysts are typically enlistees. They are literally 19 years old from rural America. They've gone to boot camp. They have
played a lot of video games as preparation.
Perhaps a lot of them have. They haven't done drugs, and that allows them to go into the world of intelligence. And then it's their job to sit in at a computer station, typically in Nevada, but also here in California, the Beale Air Force Base, not too far away, and watch people day in and day out. So they, the 19-year-olds, actually very aware of the problems that with the technology, in fact, that it is very inaccurate. So you'll see, as we try to illustrate in the book, that they make the call, we think they are women and children, we think you're making a mistake. And the pilots say, well, you know, our soldiers are in danger, we need to act fast. And so they push the button and kill them. And literally within minutes, they discover, women emerge from the vehicle, start waving white scarves, and they realize they made a mistake.
And that's in the transcripts that you saw.
That's in the transcripts.
There's also, this is an ambitious book in so many ways. I was struck, Khalil, about the fact that you actually explain in the book how surveillance system works.
Exactly. So this is Protap's work, digging up all the nitty-gritty and technical.
You just gave
aspects.
Us all the background of drones and how they, yeah. But
that's right. And how there are different ways of spying on people that the NSA and other intelligence agencies use. The hacking, tracking.
We break it into four different methods: hacking, tracking, mass surveillance, and analysis. So they can track your phone if you have a cell phone. They can hack into your computer. They can hack everybody's data, as Snowden illustrated, mass surveillance. And then the big thing is putting it all together and figuring out what the patterns are. And this is the big data stuff that Silicon Valley is so famous for, is how do we pinpoint who, you know, who is guilty? And really, the answer is actually simple, I think, is technology can't actually tell you who's guilty. It can only give you a lot of guesses, and they could be wrong. Without people on the ground, you are very likely to kill innocent people, and you're using it as a substitute for justice, which is...
I just have to ask you, though, because this came up with the conversation with Snowden yesterday about the complicity of private companies. I mean, this is what sets you off on your
Indeed.
Odyssey, but also corporations and social media. I mean, they all play a complicitous role.
You know, it's interesting. I was at Stanford not too long ago, and the former head of the NSA was there, and he said, "You think we're bad? Do you have any idea what Facebook and Google have on you?" And there's an argument to that.
I brought that up last night. I said, in fact, in an interview with Eric Schmidt, I said, you know everything there is to know. You say do no evil, but you could do all kinds of evil.
Absolutely. And in the hands of somebody like Donald Trump or Barack Obama, this could be very dangerous.
Well, I'm going to bring our listeners into this. We're talking about, and with investigative journalist Pratap Chatterjee and editorial cartoonist Khalil Bendeed, about a history that they present of drone warfare and mass surveillance in Verex. It's a graphic novel, and it is a work that brings up some of these essential questions that we're broaching here, but also questions related to journalism and how journalism finds often light and finds answers to questions that need to have answers to them. Also, the whole question sometimes arises, as it did in this conversation I had with Snowden, he was live from Moscow by Skype, about the time. And some of you remember it was a time that was fraught with all kinds of anxiety because of 9/11. Remember all the color coding and all the rest of it. And so the government's response to this was always, well, you know, there's terrible things out there. We have to spread the net as wide as we can. Drone warfare, we're becoming more and more. We can't get the boots on the ground and the intelligence that way, so we have to use drones and so forth. I'd like to have listeners weigh in on this and hear your thoughts as we talk about these subjects that still remain very important and very integral to us. Our toll-free number is available. Let me give it to you so you can join us. It's 866-733-6786. We do welcome your calls and invite them. Feel free to bring questions or comments to the fore. 866-733-6786 is the number to call, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Kinds of things that you, you covered, as I say, such a broad range here. What kind of things did you walk away from in terms of policy, if anything?
Well, I think it's...
Policy change or policy implementation?
Well, I would say that one of the problems with both big data and with drone warfare is the military depends on algorithms. And computers drive a lot of this. So we do have soldiers, and we talk to these soldiers, but we trust technology. We believe, all of us, that technology is magic. And so I think it's really important for the military and the government. There's actually a companion journalistic report that I produced called Drone Inc. And in that, there are actually a lot of policy recommendations, and I hope to actually I have discussed it with people in the military. I think there are a lot of changes that can be done to make sure that innocent people are not caught up in warfare.
But forgive me if I push back along a different line, because people always bring up the question of security. And when a terrorist attack happens, as 9/11 did, they ask, why wasn't there more surveillance? Why didn't we take advantage of technology to stop this? Because the tools do exist. And you don't want corporations or democratically, it comes across in your book, elected governments to control them. Who should? Should they not be used?
Well, would you want a computer program to decide whether you live or die here in California?
Do I want a computer program to decide? No.
I mean, that's essentially what drone warfare and mass surveillance is doing. They're deciding whether or not you have the right to live or die.
It's like everything else. It's a matter of balance. I mean, on the one hand, you have the law, the Constitution, which says certain things. The NSA were forced to admit that they were spying on people. They were lying up to the Snowden revelations that they weren't doing that. And then when it was impossible to refute, they started saying, well, we're not doing that wittingly.
And if you have, if you have a warrant.
Yeah, James Clapper was saying, in effect, we didn't see the email. We didn't read the emails. I mean, we kept backpedaling on
right.
that.
Right.
Well, if you have
head
a warrant,
of the, head of intelligence, James Clapper. Excuse me. Yeah.
So Barack Obama came up with this line that we're only using metadata, not the data itself. Meaning, we just look at your pattern of calls. If you're calling 5 or 10 times this person who we're suspecting of being a terrorist, we pay attention to that.
The irony is, though, that there are people who would say, I mean, 90% of our citizens were actually being surveilled. But there are those people who say, look, I didn't do anything wrong. I don't care. My life's an open book. For the sake of safety, if they're going to catch a terrorist, let them. I mean, like as you suggested before, social media knows everything anyway, right?
But the problem is, in fact, if they're mostly killing innocent people, which we do believe, in fact,
you're talking about people, drones as opposed to surveillance.
Well, even with mass surveillance, if you're pulling up everybody's data, and you're using it to a lot of people believe that Facebook knows everything about them. But actually, you'd be surprised, when you look at the ads that pop up in your feed and that sort of thing, that in fact, I think they often make a lot of bad guesses. And I would say that this technology is far from perfect and actually deeply problematic.
Well, one of the worst guesses came out in the congressional hearings that took place just a week and a half or so ago, when Al Franken said, in his usually often humorous way, when he was talking to a Facebook lawyer, he said, "Let me get this straight. You guys can connect billions and billions of dots, but you can't determine that rubles are being paid to you for these bots or whatever they are." Let me bring our callers in, and we'll begin, Christy, with you. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I'm interested in the money trails that you might have uncovered. Is who's benefiting in terms of bottom line corporations that are involved in this technology and the drone warfare?
Yeah, thank you for that, Christy. Protap, you did follow a lot of the money. What'd you find?
I did it, indeed. And so there is a multi-billion-dollar industry that makes a surveillance gear, and they sell it to what they call law enforcement agencies. So that's everybody from police, local police, all the way up to the CIA and the NSA. So they're companies in this country, in Silicon Valley. They're companies that we name in Europe, like Amisys from France, Gamma from Germany, Hacking Team from Italy, who sell this technology and make a lot of money out of it. And we, in fact, list examples of companies, of countries that they've done deals with, like Egypt and Libya and Syria. But that is also true here in the United States. I'll name one company we mention in the book, which is Harris of Florida. If you've ever heard of a stingray, which is a device used to follow people in municipalities in the United States, it's made by a company in Florida, and it's sold to police across the country. So there's a lot of money in this, and if you want to look at the drone warfare, the simplest and easiest way to the companies that are deeply involved in this are General Atomics from right here in California, down in San Diego, that makes the Reaper drone, the Predator drone, the Hellfire missile, and then pretty much every big weapons manufacturer has a piece of this pie. So that's Northrop Grumman, that is Lockheed Martin, that's Raytheon, L3, all of them have multi-billion-dollar contracts in this business.
It's big money, and we'll go to more of your calls. Let me go next to Tom in Los Gatos. Tom, you're on the air.
Well, good morning, Michael, and thanks for taking my call. I once heard a lawyer said he'd rather see 100 criminals go free, murderers specifically, than convict one person wrongfully for a capital crime like murder. I was wondering if that philosophy is fitting in with our drone strikes, as I also read that for every innocent civilian killed, 10 terrorists or more created, family members and friends of the dead victims who are, of course, completely outraged. So I was wondering what the statistics are regarding the number of civilians versus, confirmed terrorists killed.
Yeah, Tom, thanks for the question. Can we get a handle on statistics or numbers here? In fact, I've got a listener I want to dovetail with that, but go ahead.
Sure, there are numbers. The Obama administration, actually, about 2 years ago, put out some numbers in which they claimed that they were only killing 2% innocent people. They gave a specific number, at least 64 innocent people were killed out of about 3,000. There are other people who count this. There's the New America Foundation, the Long War Journal, and the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, where I worked, where their estimate is much higher. It's 22%, and they actually get information from newspapers in Pakistan and Yemen. But it is also not based on exhaustive investigations on the ground. The number of names that we have of quote-unquote confirmed terrorists who have never, I might add, been given an opportunity to defend themselves and to be able to make sure that they haven't been, is probably 100. There's Anwar Awlaki and people like that who never saw their day in court. So I believe in the Western canon, which is you are innocent until proven guilty. And I think that George Bush actually provided a forum, military tribunals, flawed though it was, to actually allow people to defend themselves. And guess what? 90% of those people have been let go.
Prothap Chatterjee here with us in studio, Executive Director of Corp Watch, and Khalil Bendib. They're partners, actually, in a book that was a graphic novel that's out there called Varex, The True History of Whistleblowers, Drone Warfare, and Mass Surveillance. And I'm looking at a couple of moral questions being raised by listeners. Rick says, war is evil, but with more terrorists who routinely use kids as shields, what can be done? It would seem to be a mistake to let terrorism run free because there's one child on every death convoy. And another big moral question from Mike, do you feel a book like this may give too much information to our enemies?
I don't think we go into the stuff that's not already public information. It's just that it's not being played by the media as much as we'd like. It's stuff, some of it you've uncovered yourself directly, Prothap, but a lot of it is perfectly unclassified.
All the information in the book is unclassified. I would challenge most of the classified information and would be happy to get my hands on it. I don't think we're giving away secrets. I think we are actually exposing a illegal and wrongful war.
What about that moral question, though? I mean, you may have innocent lives, but if it stops terrorist acts,
Kill people in inner city America by drone?
It's the same argument they make about torture. Torture is illegal, but George Bush and now Donald Trump are saying we don't care, it's illegal because...
You mean enhanced interrogation?
Because that's how, you know, that's how bad they are, and we need to stoop to their level if we're going to solve the problem, which I don't think is the correct approach.
Here's Joseph who writes, aren't drones merely a continuing extension of technology in our modern warfare? The military calls such toys force multipliers, better than boots on the ground, in my opinion.
Well, the problem with that, it is true. The military certainly says that. And I think the problem with that is that because you're fighting a war from halfway across the world with soldiers who are literally just out of high school, who don't speak the language, don't know the culture, you're actually more likely to make mistakes. And in my research, and I've traveled to Iraq 4 times, Afghanistan 4 times, Pakistan 3 times, throughout this region, I found that, in fact, they're less likely to know what's happening around them if they're not present on the ground. And I think...
It's a little dangerous. Aren't you? You're of Indian descent, right?
Indian. It's actually very difficult to get a visa to Pakistan.
I was going to say, you must have some problems there, I would assume, with your name and all. Actually, there's some of that in the book.
Indeed.
Let me bring another caller on here. And it's a caller joining us from Blairsville, Georgia. Sam, you're on the air.
It's Jim.
Yeah, Jim,
my question is concerning the distinction between a drone and a manned aircraft. They do the same function. We don't talk much about the manned aircraft because there are more drones, and they are safer because they do protect the pilot.
The old-fashioned idea that somebody would be in the plane and drop a bomb is something drone warfare is trying to get away from. The problem is that drone warfare, ostensibly safer, quote-unquote, for our soldiers here, actually doesn't solve problems. It creates more problems. It's extremely complicated, as we show in the book. There are many levels, many different stations communicating with one another. There's a lot of room for error. And we're creating not only problems for people who are on the other end who may not be culpable, or at least some of them are not, but also we're creating blowback for ourselves, and we're creating a lot of people who are here supposedly safe, but who end up with PTSD and some serious mental issues. And
should you not be concerned with the act rather than the vehicle for the act?
Actually, you know what? I'm going to agree with the caller, and I think I'll probably annoy a lot of people on the left who think that a drone is a unique vehicle. I don't think it is. I think a manned aircraft is actually more likely to spot innocent people. And in fact, they use nowadays the same technology. There was, in fact, a big debate inside the military over whether or not they should use the Global Hawk, which is this huge vehicle that needs 500 people to operate, or U-2 aircraft. Now, any listener who knows of the U-2 aircraft knows it's over 60 years old. And the Air Force decided the U-2
Gary Powers.
Gary Powers. That is actually a more accurate way of getting information than a drone. Drones are deeply, deeply inaccurate.
Well, let me thank the caller. Was it hard to draw some of this technology?
It seemed
challenging.
What was challenging was making complex technical information into something that's approachable, that's easy to look at.
The lay audience could not only see but understand.
Right.
But you do some really remarkable work with... I mean, your cartoons of Obama look like Obama.
Yes. Well, they're not cartoons anymore. In this book, they're more like portraits because it's not as cartoony a style as I'm used to in my editorial cartoons. This is a little bit more realistic, so I try to portray him a little more fairly.
We should also mention that Khalil co-hosts a weekly radio program called Voices of the Middle East on KPFA in Berkeley. And Chris writes, I would suspect that a fair amount of the difference between one group's statistics and another's over innocent lives lost has to do with the definition of innocent. Interesting point. Let me take another call. Let me go next to Dublin, not Ireland, but here in the East Bay. James, go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. What I'm wondering is, with these drone strikes, are we causing more problems than we're solving? I mean, like, a Predator drone is small. It's light-colored, it flies at high altitude, so it can be a bright, sunny day, and just a missile comes screaming out of the sky. If that was the case in Dublin, my kids would never leave my side, and I would do anything in my power to make that stop. And if the country on the other side of the world that was responsible for dropping those missiles called me a terrorist, I wouldn't care. I would still do anything I could to make that stop happening.
Exactly. And what you bring up also is something we haven't mentioned yet, is the fact that beyond the thousands, I think over 6,000 so far, victims of these drone strikes in those countries, beyond that, you have the uncounted victims who are people subjected to the constant knowledge that this is flying over them. It's making a lot of noise. It sounds like a lawnmower that's on 24/7. It drives people crazy, especially knowing that this lawnmower might actually kill you.
There's an Amnesty report called Will I Be Next, which I think really sums that up.
Well, Khalil and Protap, thank you very much. Congratulations on the book. Again, it's called VARAX. It's V-A-R-A-X. And it digs into the history and the ethics surrounding drones and surveillance. And there's a lot to read in there and a lot to learn. Thank you both for being here.
There's a website, by the way, VARAXcomic.net, and you can find out more about the background.
All right. Thank you again, both of you. Another hour up ahead. We're going to talk to Tony Wheeler, Lonely Planet. Talk about travel when we return and the whole Lonely Planet story. It's quite a story. Stay tuned for that. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.